This is Between the Covers. I'm Jim Schumach, and welcome. My guest today is novelist and short story writer Thomas Carrageson, T.C. Boyle. Born in Peekskill, New York in 1948, he is the author of 12 novels, including, but not limited to, East is East, The Tortilla Curtain, and The Women. He has also published 9 short story collections, most recently in paperback, Wild Child. His most recent novel, When the Killing's Done, has just been published in hardback by Viking. Welcome again to Between the Covers, Tom.
Always nice to be here, Jim.
You studied at Iowa under John Cheever and John Irving.
And Vance Bourgeli.
And Vance Bourgeli. Oh, Confessions of a Spent Youth. Wonderful book.
Yes.
We're coming up on Cheever's centenary. Was he a good teacher for you, Tom?
Cheever was a huge influence in my life as a writer. And as someone who gave me a lot of encouragement and liked what I was doing. That's what I needed most of all. As far as teaching, John seemed a bit lost. He wasn't a natural-born teacher, and he hadn't had much experience. And furthermore, he was pretty old at that point, 62, I believe, and I can't imagine that anyone could even walk and talk at that advanced age, but there he was. And he seemed a little bit baffled by us, but he sure helped me out a lot.
What books do you use today that you find your students find the most pleasure in reading?
I will typically, particularly in the grad class where they're often writing novels, use some novels to illustrate different types of approaches and often very contemporary novels. For instance, we have Brooklyn by Colm Toybean, a wonderful book written in just the most traditional manner possible, but brilliantly and beautifully done. How does he do this? Well, we read it and we examine that. I'm hoping to use Jennifer Egan's The Keep for its playfulness and its beauty. Books that I love to use also are by Stuart Onan, Louise Erdrich, Richard Ford. And I also have a collection that I put together called Double Takes back in 2003, which needs to be revised, by the way. I don't think I'll ever have the strength to do it, but it's 30 contemporary short story writers, 2 stories of each. And that's been a boon for me and for the students because they don't have to buy individual copies of each author's book.
In the battle between the Kindle and things like that and a real paper book, where do you fall?
Well, as you know, Jim, we've talked many, many times on many subjects. I'm a Luddite. I hate all machines of any kind. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The Terminator starring our former governor of California, but the machines had taken over the world. Well, we live there now. The machines have taken it over. They do whatever they want. We're addicted to them. I hate machines. I hate apps. I hate anything like this. I mean, I have a cell phone in my pocket, not a smartphone, just a cell phone. It's adequate to my purpose. I use it as a tool. When I come into the airport, as I did today, and I can't find my escort, well, I turn it on and I call her. Then I turn it off. You know, I don't understand the madness for being connected all the time, everywhere. And so, to get back to your question, my wife has a Kindle and she enjoys it. She particularly enjoys the downloading of the out-of-print free stuff from 1900, you know, and she loves that. Great. I like to have an actual book because it's a work of art. I love the cover art, for instance. I've been fortunate in that my publisher always asks me about the cover art and asks me for ideas and runs it by me. On this new book, for instance, When the Killing's Done, it wraps. It's a beautiful, disturbing picture of Anacapa Island with a gull flying and this red sky and a savage sea. And it wraps all the way around with no print on the back. I mean, this is a picture. It's a beautiful thing. There's a whole experience of the book that, of course, you know, I'm used to, as you are, because we didn't have any other option. Further, I do my work on a computer, so I'm my email. I run my business this way. I'm staring into a screen for 5 hours every day. When that's done, I don't want to stare into a screen anymore. I want to go out in the woods with a book and read it someplace. I want to listen to music. I want to dream. I just don't want to be connected all the time. It's a kind of sickness, really.
Do you think it's allied to our current fear of being alone.
Wow. I didn't know we had such a fear, Jim.
I believe we do, Tom.
I have a fear of not being alone. You know? No, I'm a very public guy. You know me. I'm out before crowds all the time. I'm one of the few authors who's an extrovert. I love it. On the other hand, I have a very private side, too, and that's how I get my work done. I like solitude. Yes, I can come back to a family and friends and fans and supporters, and you know, it's great. But I don't have a fear of being alone. Not yet, anyway. I like it.
I wasn't pointing out you. I was pointing out
us,
others.
Us in society. Maybe. Right. Maybe. Well, there is the idea that you might be missing something. And I think it's especially true of young people who are looking for connections. Curiously to this, in the past year, I've met several couples who met through the internet dating scene. There's no more of the old, I feel like the savage out of Brave New World. I mean, I met my wife in a bar. I don't think that happens anymore. You know, everything is vetted, but it seems to work and it makes sense, but it takes some of the danger and the slime out of it, you know?
You've dedicated your new novel to your daughter, Carrie. I was wondering, what's she doing these days with her life? I know she's a Iowa Writers' Workshop grad and a published author.
Well, Carrie Cavache Boyle, my daughter, gets a dedication here because she went out to Santa Cruz Island with me and the biologists, braved the ghosts, as I say, because there's a broken-down house with a couple of old mattresses on the floor at the far end of Santa Cruz Island, which is, by the way, four times bigger than Manhattan and uninhabited. The biologists slept in tents outside, two female biologists, because they were afraid of the ghost that inhabits that house. Carrie and I had no problem with the ghost. We slept inside, so she gets it. She is writing, but she's concentrating more on film these days because her mate, Jameson Fry, is a film director, and the two of them are working together, doing scripts, and hoping to have his first major directorial debut coming soon. In the meanwhile, they have pioneered the field of the book trailer, and they've made book trailers for a number of authors, including me. And, of course, they made one for When the Killing's Done, which is just out now on the internet. It's a very interesting art form.
Do you think the future for authors will be not in touring, but on doing a massive television satellite tour?
I suppose that could be in the cards. Again, if we're talking about everyone living in a compound with a wall around it and having everything delivered to the door, then I suppose that's the next step. I mean, who wants dirty human contact? Who wants to touch anyone? Who wants to know your neighbors or speak with somebody at the grocery store or go to the video store, which now doesn't exist anymore? There's no sense of community. It's everybody is for himself and hiding behind walls. So I suppose so. You know, I suppose that's the way it's going to go.
Let's move on to your book itself and tell
us. Yeah, but this is so much fun talking about the dislocations of the world with all of this technology and what it's done to us. Jeez. So we can segue into the book in that I'm writing another book about an idealized society or a removed society or someone who can go to an island and be away from everyone else. This is very enchanting for me to dream about this sort of thing.
And the North Channel Islands they're kind of like the foothills in the ocean of the Santa Monica Mountains, brought there by a basalt flow, right?
They seem to be an extension of the Santa Monica Mountains out into the ocean, yes. They are part of the national park, our national parks now. They are the least visited, though, of the national parks because they are inaccessible, you know, accessible only by water.
Were they ever inhabited by an Indian or Native American tribe?
The Chumash inhabited these islands. They were decimated by disease when the Spanish first came there and were removed from the islands, as in the Island of the Blue Dolphin, Scott O'Dell's wonderful children's book in the late 1700s. And there are many, Chumash ruins, middens and so on. You can go anywhere on the islands and see arrowheads and mortars and pestles and all this stuff. So they'd been inhabited for centuries, by the Chumash. And then once the Spanish and then later the Mexicans, when they broke away from Spain, took over, they were granted to individuals, and individuals lived on those islands until very recently. In fact, on Santa Rosa Island, the Vail and Vickers concern are still there, although the Park Service is edging them out so that these islands will be entirely uninhabited except as national parks.
And for those of you who have just joined us, this is Jim Schumach with Between the Covers. My guest today, T.C. Boyle. Why don't you give us just the basic look at the story you're telling in When the Killing's Done?
Sure. As you know, I write a lot about ecological concerns. And beyond ecological concerns, what is our status on this mysterious planet as king of the animals? Is it just a kind of redness and tooth and claw of nature that allows us to be like that? How do we treat the other animals? And so, for instance, this book takes off with some historical antecedents from efforts to restore the ecosystem on Anacapa and Santa Cruz in the last decade. I became aware of this because of press coverage in our local newspapers, the Santa Barbara News Press, the Ventura paper, and the LA Times. It begins in 2001, and I have created characters around people who were actually involved in protests against what the Park Service and Nature Conservancy were doing. So in 2001, the Park Service decided to exterminate the invasive rats on Anacapa Island. They had been there now for 150 years, since the wreck of the Winfield Scott paddle wheel steamer. However, in that time, they were causing havoc amongst the ground nesting birds that are particular to this chain of islands and are fairly rare throughout the world, like the Cassin's auklet, for instance. They would eat the eggs and the nestlings of these birds because these birds evolved to nest on the ground in the absence of predators. All right, so the Park Service decided that in the interest of preserving these species, the rats must be eliminated because rats are throughout the world. They're pandemic. There were protests. And in my telling, a guy and his confederate go out in his own boat. As the Park Service drops brodofecum, that is, the same rat poison that that you use in a decon bait and that people with heart problems are taking even now, a blood thinner. Vitamin K is the antidote. They come out with big backpacks of vitamin K and throw it all over the island. It doesn't work, of course, and my antagonist, his name is Dave LaJoy. He's 42. He's a Santa Barbara businessman. He wears his hair in dreadlocks, and he is a vegetarian and an animal rights activist. He is the guy who does it. He winds up being arrested for interfering with a Park Service operation and feeding animals in a national park without a permit. Subsequently, he takes the fight to Santa Cruz Island. Santa Cruz Island is much more complicated, but in short, Park Service and Nature Conservancy realize that first the sheep must be removed because the sheep are changing the ecology of the island radically by chewing everything down to the dirt. And then the invasive pigs that had been there for 150 years, the feral pigs, the hogs, the wild boars, had to be removed also because they're digging allowed invasive plants to get a foothold rather than native plants. And also, their eating of all the tubers and the acorns in particular gave us just a remnant population of ancient trees and no new trees growing, which in turn helps change the ecology of the island because you don't have trees on the ridgeline catching all the mist, which is a major source of moisture here. So they felt that they wanted to restore this to a time before these invasives were in place, but, of course, with unforeseen consequences, which is why I'm writing the book.
Your protagonist is the bureaucrat Alma Boyd Takasui. Give us a sense of who she is and what she stands for.
Alma is in charge as a Park Service employee, of this operation to eliminate the invasives. More to the point, to explain this in public meetings to the public. And the aforementioned Dave LaJoy, of course, interrupts her during these meetings and causes her a great deal of grief in many, many ways. She understands that, in her mind, certain species have to be sacrificed in order to preserve others, and she's willing to make that sacrifice. Ironically, she and Dave pretty much believe in the same thing. They're both vegetarians. They believe in preserving the environment and in preserving animals and preserving species. Both are intransigent, and both take a hard line. Neither will admit any ground in this war that they begin to wage against one another. Dave, for all his imperfections, and he has many, he's one of these guys who is angry all the time, angry at everything, does have a point, and his point is that all life is sacred, and that no one has the right to manipulate nature or to destroy any animal for any reason whatsoever. Alma feels the same way, but is more practical, perhaps. Neither position is entirely consistent, neither Alma's nor Dave's. And again, as with my book, The Tortilla Curtain, from 1995, to which this has been compared a lot, I'm giving you something to, a scenario to enter. And you make up your own mind on these issues. I'm just trying to broaden the debate and to meditate on it. And yes, Dave's position might not be entirely consistent. His girlfriend is a vegan, and she is trying to wean him off of the last remaining protein food he's eating that's not a plant food, and that is eggs. And there might be some symbolic value there. I don't know. I leave that to the reader to decide. He wants to leave all animals alone. And yet, when he puts in a new lawn at his house and finds holes in it being dug by raccoons, he traps them in a heart trap, of course. But he must then remove them from the immediate vicinity, and he does so with, I won't reveal exactly where he takes them, but it is pretty frightening. And yet, he is manipulating nature to some degree.
We're facing some huge problems right now with the diminishment of some of the tiniest creatures that support us, like plankton and bees. It's almost like we are the creators of the imbalance. We're the King Kong in the Garden of Eden, as it were.
Of course, the problem is overpopulation. When we addressed this, when we talked about A Friend of the Earth back in the year 2000, my book about global warming that projects 25 years into the future to 2025. Yes, of course. I'm part of the problem, too. Of course I am, living in this society that is obsessed with things, possessions, product, etc. And also just being an animal alive on the earth. I have reproduced. You've reproduced. You know, we're part of the problem. But we can intellectualize it all we want. We're still animals, and we're still subject to all of the laws that other animals are subject to. And by the same token, we reproduce freely. 7 billion of us.
So recognizing all the problems that are out there, has there been any change you made in your life that is appreciable in dealing with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost hopeless. Any environmentalist would tell you that it's utterly hopeless, any hope for, you know, our species. But yet, I can't help recycling. I'm a fanatic of recycling. Nothing goes through our place that's not recycled. Every scrap of food goes into the compost. Every leaf that falls is part of a natural yard, you know. But I have the luxury of doing that because I do have a yard and I do have a house. What about the third of the people in the world who have no house and no food and are starving to death right now? What do we do with them? And further, what about the California condor, for instance? I applaud the fact that we have rescued this animal from extinction and spent a good deal of effort and money on preserving it. What do we spend on one of these animals as opposed to all the people dying of starvation as we speak here tonight? What is the relative value of these things? Because there are only a couple of hundred of those, are they worth more than any thousands of people whom we don't know and don't see? I don't know. Any kind of preservation brings up all these questions. Is it our right to eat every last thing until there's nothing left? Which is, of course, what is going to happen. As Cormac McCarthy pointed out in the road.
A wise man, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I love the book, and this was the scenario that I was talking about, seeing as the future.
Would you give a reading now from When the Killing's Done, Tom? And for those of you who have just joined us, this is Jim Schumach with Between the Covers. My guest today, T.C. Boyle, reading from his new novel.
This little excerpt takes place during a meeting at a restaurant during which Alma and some of the others involved in the pig eradication are discussing the progress of their operation. The fact was that these hogs, Santa Cruz Island hogs, were a discrete population that had had no interaction with outside populations in 150 years, and thus could carry leptospirosis, foot and mouth disease, mutations of common bacteria and viruses that could burn through the American hog industry and leave it twitching in the mud. So there was no choice but to euthanize them. With bullets, two each, the first to the heart, the second to the head, according to the American Veterinary Association guidelines. Clean kills, as swift and final as fate. And the carcasses, all that wild-bred pork? The carcasses were to be left where they lay for the entertainment of the ravens and the benefit of the soil. The thing is, Frazier is saying, now dabbing at a bright smear of egg and hollandaise at the corner of his mouth, with pigs, you get 90% of them right off, but it's that remaining 10% that gives you hell. And you can't run the risk of missing a single individual, because that could be a pregnant sow for all you know, and then the whole business just starts in over again. The oatmeal goes down like a brick, the wrong thing to order, definitely the wrong thing. Alma's stomach is on fire suddenly, too much coffee, too much tension, dealing with her mother, hitting the squirrel, fighting traffic to get here. And she has to square herself in the chair and sit rigid a moment till the burning passes. Is she developing an ulcer? Is that it? Ariel starts when? Next week? That's what you're projecting? Freeman asks, leaning into the table, the rind of his grapefruit at one elbow, coffee cup at the other. The pen in his breast pocket has left a dark blue Rorschach blot on his pale blue shirt, and the silver points of his bolo tie are tarnished, or maybe they're smudged with ink. But his eyes are bright. He's attached to the notion of the park superintendent as a man of action, like the legendary Bill Ahorn, who flew into San Miguel to personally pull the trigger on the last pregnant Jenny, thus ending the occupation of the island by introduced mules. And Alma knows he's angling for an invitation. Frazier nods genially. As best we can figure, because we're already having good success on the ground, but we need to get up on the ridges and work our way down. And I tell you, you only do a kill if you can get the whole group. If there's a chance even one will get away, you draw back, because you understand these are very clever animals. They say they're smarter than dogs, smart as a 3-year-old child, for that matter. But for my money, even the dopiest dog beats that. Anyway, they'll communicate to the others and go into hiding, and that's a nightmare. Alma catches the waitress's eye from across the room, thinking to expedite things and get the check now. But the waitress misinterprets her meaning and brings the coffee pot back round. Frazier, gesturing broadly now, holds out his cup to be refilled, giving the girl a quick wink, and then going on about how, while Ariel is indispensable, the real hunt takes place on the ground now that the dogs, his own dogs, from New Zealand, are out of quarantine. And then Freeman and Annabelle, edging their cups forward for refills while Alma lays a palm over hers and mouths, "Check, please." He brings up his Judas pigs, a concept so devious it gives her a thrill every time he mentions it. Annabelle, who to this point hasn't been so closely involved with the details of the hunt as she herself has, gives him a bemused smile and drops her voice. "Judas pigs?" she echoes. Her look says, "Amuse me." And Frazier stops right there to take in that look and sweep his eyes over the restaurant, the retreating waitress, the view out the window before he comes back to her. "Oh, yeah," he says. "Very effective in an operation like this. You see, leaning in over his plate to pin her with his gaze. "We use their own sex drive against them. And if that seems unfair, well, dearie, I guess it is. But this isn't a game. This is war, all-out war. And wave goodbye to the little piggies." "Okay," Annabelle says, flashing a smile. "We can all agree with that. But what do you mean?" "What we do is we trap as many as we can and hope to find a couple females in estrus. These things will breed all year round in this climate. So it's not so hard as you might think, especially if you cage a boar with them for a day or two. Then we radio collar the females and let them go." He's leaning so far over the table he's practically in her lap at this point, and Alma has to remind herself, while sitting rigid and fighting down the gas pains, that it doesn't really matter to her one way or the other if he finds a little solace wherever he can. "And you'd be surprised," he says. "Or maybe not. Maybe it's just what you'd figure. But each of those females will wind up with a whole parade of boars around her, rooting and fighting and sniffing her up. Even the wiliest old scarred-up paranoid razorback will come charging out of his hole for a chance at that. And it can bring in a whole bloody contingent of sows and juveniles, too, whether they're in heat or not, just to be close to the action, like a pig disco. And then we track them and move in." He pauses to take a sip of coffee, all three of them playing that scenario over in their heads, the abrasive hides, the mobile snouts, pig sex. "And believe me," he says, "nobody gets out alive."
Thanks for reading that, Tom.
You're welcome, Jim.
For Between the Covers, this is Jim Schumach, my guest today, novelist and short story writer T.C. Boyle. His most recent short story collection, Wild Child, has just been published in paperback, and his current novel, When the Killing's Done, has been published in hardback by Viking. It's always great to see you, Tom. Thanks so much for dropping by this morning.
Likewise, Jim.